Well, good morning again. Like I said before, against better judgment, I've decided to have a question time at the end today. Go easy on me. Let's see how we go. The highest award, here's a question for you. The highest award that you can receive in Australia is what? Does anyone know the highest award available? Marie thinks Victoria crosses it. Victoria Cross, that's right. The highest award you can get in Australia is the award for bravery. Now, in 1991, Australia moved from the imperial system for the Victoria Cross. 91 Australians received the Victoria Cross under the English system. We moved to an Australian system. And since 1991, only 4 Victoria Crosses have been handed out. One of those recipients is Corporal Daniel Kieran. Now, the Australian newspaper recorded the details as follows. It says, Kieran was awarded the Victoria Cross for his actions in a firefight with insurgents during the Battle of Derepet. During the battle, Kieran, with complete disregard for his own safety, repeatedly exposed himself to enemy fire to draw fire away from a team treating a battle casualty. Kieran's actions were key in allowing the coalition forces to withdraw without further casualties. So understand what he did. He repeatedly stepped out into the line of fire, drawing the fire from the insurgents so that they weren't focusing on the team over here dealing with the guy that had been shot. Now, not everyone can show this level of courage. That's why only 4 Victoria Crosses in the last 20 years or so. But my guess is everyone here, male and female alike, would rather be known as being courageous as opposed to cowardly. I mean, who wants to be known as a coward, right? We want to be courageous, just not sure how to be sometimes. Now, if you want to be a courageous person, in particular a courageous Christian, Judges chapter 4 is the passage for you. Now, I've titled the sermon. You've got the sermon outline there in front of you. I've titled it A Few Good Women, because it's the women of this story that turn out to be the courageous ones. Right? The women are the heroes. They are the ones that are doing the tough things here. Right? These women, they're not decorations like the music industry would have us believe women are today. These women show courage in ways that the men in this episode decidedly lack. But what is courage? I mean, this is what we're looking at today. What is courage? How do we know if we're courageous or not? When Corporal Kieran was interviewed about his medal, I saw him on the TV, I remember him saying he thought his actions were probably more stupid than courageous. Now, is he right in that? I mean, what's the difference between courage and stupidity? Let me show you some photos. And let's ask ourselves whether we think these people are showing courage or stupidity. Here's the first one. Cliff camping. Pitching a tent on the side of a massive cliff and spending the night there. I reckon that as soon as it went dark, I'd be busting to go to the toilet and have to stay there the whole night. Here's the next one. Climbing the redwoods. What? Why? Why? Is there anything up there? Are they sitting on the Trolltunga Rock in Norway? Look at it. Is that courageous or stupid? How about this one? Jumping on the Trollgen Rock in Norway. I don't get it. Extreme skiing in what is there? Where is he going to land? In Wyoming. Is this courage? How about sitting around in Yosemite on the edge of a cliff? Is that courageous or stupid? How do you define courage? Is that courageous? Is that what we aspire to be? What we're going to be doing today is we're going to be defining what courage is, and then we're going to look at some examples. Once we've got our definition, we're going to look at some examples of where we can potentially leave the path of cowardice that we're currently maybe on and head down the path of courage. Right? I hope that's a good idea for today. Good goal, so let's dive in. Now, our passage begins, if you've got the passage open there, number page 374, it begins in the way that's going to become all too familiar to us before this series on Judges is out. Chapter 4, verse 1. Again, The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord now that Ehud was dead. All right, just like when the teacher leaves the classroom, so too when Israel's judge dies, the people run amok. So, following this apostasy, we read in verse 2, "So the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Sisera, the commander of his army, was based in Harosheth Hagoyim." So God reproves Israel, this time using a king called Jabin. But straight away, Jabin moves into the background as we're introduced to the commander of his army, Sisera. And Sisera has 900 chariots, all right? He had the advantage in terms of the military hardware of the day, and he used that military hardware to oppress Israel cruelly for 20 years, we see in verse 3. Oppress them cruelly. So here's the question, what did Israel do? What are we going to do? Well, the answer comes in the very next verse. Now Deborah, we read, verse 4. Now Deborah, a prophet, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading, literally judging Israel at that time. Now, in the Hebrew, the word Deborah is placed at the beginning of the sentence for emphasis. Why does it start with a name? It's because the mention of a woman judging Israel is supposed to stand out to us. You see, Deborah is the only woman in the whole Bible who is actually sanctioned to be leading God's people. God chooses other women in the Bible to be prophets, but none of them step up to be a leader of God's people. In fact, and this is a somewhat controversial passage, in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, God expressly forbids women from leading mixed congregations in the church. Now, women are allowed to lead women in the Bible, but God has reserved the leadership of mixed congregations to men. So a woman leading Israel comes as a complete surprise to us as readers. And there are two things we need to say about this. Now, the first is this. If there's a woman leading Israel, we need to ask the question, well, where are the men? Okay? We've got a few good women here. Where are the good men? The picture we're given in Judges chapter 4 is of a vacuum of male leadership. This whole passage is scathing of men who lack the manhood, let the hearer understand, to step up and lead. Where are the good men? But the second thing to note here is how the women in this chapter don't just sit around waiting for the men to step into action. Okay? In Deborah's song, that's in chapter 5 that we didn't read, we're told that Deborah arose a mother in Israel. That's verse 7. Deborah is the hero of this passage, along with Jael. All right? So can I say to the women here today, if the men around you are too weak, too pathetic, too gutless, too impotent to step up and lead, don't sit around waiting for them to. All right? Step into action yourself. Now, I'm not encouraging women to usurp the authority of their husband or their pastor. All right? That's where Eve went wrong. We don't want to go down that path. But what I'm saying is, let's take a leaf from Deborah's book. Okay? If the fathers are refusing to step up and lead, then we need the mothers too. Well, we've got Deborah judging, and although she's a judge and a leader, she actually believes she knows she has limitations as a woman, and I'll tell you what I mean. So, judging disputes as Deborah was doing, that's one thing; leading an army is another. So we read in verse 6. She sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go. Take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead them up to Mount Tabor. I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops to the Kishon River and give him into your hands." Deborah knows that war is the realm of men. And so she calls a man to lead Israel's army. Now, this may sound a little controversial. We've currently got a push on to get women on the front line. Can I say, this push comes from a misguided ideology. It comes from this idea that equality means sameness. It's not right. Now, you and I know that the Prime Minister of Australia is not a better person than the guy that collects our garbage. They've just got different jobs, different roles. And it's the same with men and women. We are thoroughly equal before God. There is no difference to us before God. But God has made men and women different. And so he gives men and women different roles. Now let me ask you this. Imagine that we did legislate for equality, sameness, on the front line. What happens in the you know, God forbid, unfortunate situation where we have to reinstate the draft? Do you want your daughters drafted onto the front line? I certainly don't. Our friends, it'll take courage to fight against this. It's the topic for today. But we need that courage to protect our women from the horrors of war. War is the realm of men. And so Deborah calls on Barak to lead the troops. And even better than that, she assures him of victory. God will give Sisera into your hands. So what does Barak do with this awesome divine assurance? Have a look at verse 8. Barak said to her, if you go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. Now, there are some today who believe Barak does the right thing here. They look to the chapter of Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 has a big list of these wonderful men and women of faith from the Old Testament. And they see Barak's name there. And they say, oh, well, this must be the point at which the author of Hebrews is talking about. Right? So what they think Barak is doing is they're saying, oh, by saying, look, I want the prophet to come with me, I want God's prophet to come with me, that's basically the same as saying, I want God to come with me. Now, that sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? But there are three problems with that view. The first is this. You don't impose conditions on God. Right? If God commands you to do something, like he did Barak here, you don't say, oh, listen, God, I'm only going to play ball if you do this thing for me first over here. You don't put conditions on God. Second, what is Barak's condition? It's that a woman accompany him to the front line, to war. Friends, hiding behind a woman in war is not courage. It's cowardice. And the third is Deborah's response. Have a look at verse 9. Look, certainly I'll go with you, said Deborah, but because of the course you are taking, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. Now, our modern sensitivities may miss the impact of this, but to strip an army general of honor in battle and give that honor to a woman, that is the ultimate insult in the Bible. Let me read to you just one of several passages, Old Testament passages that speak of this. So this is talking about war. Okay, so Babylon was one of the enemies. And Jeremiah 51:30 says this, Babylon's warriors have stopped fighting. They remain in their strongholds. Their strength is exhausted. They have become like women. Now, Jeremiah's not writing off all women here. Jeremiah was pro-women. The Bible is pro-women. What he's saying is, women don't belong in war. And so for Barak's honour in battle to go to a woman, that's a punishment. He's doing the wrong thing here, and it's a punishment that fits the crime. Well, fortunately, Barak does not remain this way. We're told in verse 10 that he gathered an army, as commanded, and he takes his army to Mount Tabor, as commanded, and Sisera brings his army out to battle, as promised, with his 900 chariots. And in verse 14, Deborah tells Barak, advance against the enemy. And it's at this point that I think the author of the Hebrews has in mind for Barak. You see, even though he's outmanned and outgunned, he leads the charge into battle. Just like the lion in The Wizard of Oz, Barak has found his courage. And we read verse 15. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword, and Sisera got down from his chariot and fled on foot. Now, we've heard about this character before. This is the first time he's entered the stage, Sisera, and his very first act is running away, fleeing the fight. But it's not just that that's the problem. You see, it's where Sisera flees to that really highlights his cowardice. He flees to the tent of Jael, who was the wife of Heber. We were introduced to Heber and Jael back in verse 11. And Jael offers Sisera refuge in her tent. And by accepting this refuge, notice what we've got here. We've got a second man hiding behind a woman on the day of battle. And just like Barak's words betrayed him up in verse 8, so too does Sisera's words betray him in verse 20. Now, the English obscures it a little bit here, so let me read the literal translation of verse 20. It says, "Stand in the doorway of the tent," he told her, "and if a man," it's a very particular word, "if a man comes to inquire and says, 'Is there a man here?' tell him there is not." Sisera strips himself of all his manhood by saying, "There's no man in this tent." Well, the story's not over, though. God promised Sisera would be destroyed, and he promised that it would happen at the hand of a woman. And in verse 21, we learn that that woman is not Deborah, like we first thought. It's Jael. Verse 21, "But Jael, Heber's wife, picked up a tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted." She drove the tent peg through his temple into the ground, and he died. skipped a page. Now the reason, I mean, this is rated R stuff, isn't it? The reason Jael's first strike hit the mark is because putting up tents, we believe, in the ancient Near East was woman's work. So Jael is proficient with a hammer and a peg. It's women's work. However, risking one's life to kill Yahweh's enemies was not woman's work. Jael shows herself to be yet another courageous woman in this chapter. Well, no sooner has Jael done a man's job than our first man, Barak, comes by to find that Deborah's judgment upon him has fallen. The honor of killing his enemy has gone to a woman. As one commentator put it, this epic war episode ends not with two men at the heads of vast armies, but with two men standing in the presence of a woman. A courageous woman at that. So, we've got our two courageous women, our two cowardly men. If we want to emulate the courage of these women, we need to determine what it is that makes these women courageous and these men cowardly. What is the definition of courage? And if we were going to put a definition to it, it actually comes down to just one word. Protection. Okay, protection. You see, what we protect and how strongly we protect it will determine whether we are courageous or cowardly. What is it that we protect? So take Sisera to begin with. What was Sisera protecting? Well, his life. Now, that's not a bad thing, to protect your life. But the way he did it was by fleeing the army and leaving his men unprotected, leaderless, and then going and hiding behind a woman. Barak, on the other hand, he wasn't protecting his life. He was happy to go to war. He was okay to go to war. He just didn't want to go alone. So what was Barak protecting? He was protecting his reputation. It was either that he had a fear of responsibility, which a lot of men do, and people, or a fear of failure, which a lot of us do. Now again, and so he wanted someone to share that responsibility or share that failure with. Now again, protecting your reputation, it's not a bad thing in and of itself. But doing so by dragging a woman into a war zone is. In contrast, we've got Deborah. Deborah chose not to protect her safety. Okay, so girls, imagine, boys, imagine your wife is the only woman in a camp of 10,000 hardened soldiers. That would be scary enough. But on top of that, she goes to the front line. She chose not to protect her safety. And then there's Jael, who chose to take her life into her own hands. She didn't protect her own life. What had happened if she missed? What would Sisera have done to her? You see, the mark of courage, according to this chapter, is to choose not to protect something important, all right, like your reputation, your safety, your life, for the sake of something else more important. All right, you see, if Corporal Kieran had placed himself into the line of fire, let's say for the fun of it, or as a dare, or to give himself a macho reputation, that would have been stupid. All those people in the photos before, they were risking their lives for an adrenaline rush. That's stupid. Corporal Kieran, however, put his life on the line to protect the lives of his troop. And that is what makes him courageous. He chose not to protect something important for the sake of something else more important. But we're not there yet. You see, the Bible doesn't leave us with this definition of courage. There's another hero in the Bible who takes courage to the next level. And if we want to determine what true courage looks like, we need to look to this person. And that person is, of course, Jesus. Now, in all three of the synoptic gospels, synoptic, I mean Matthew, Mark, and Luke, okay, in all three of them, there is a point at which Jesus decides to turn around and start heading towards Jerusalem, in all three of them. Now, I'm going to read just one for you. This is from Matthew chapter 16. So, from that time on, all right, this is the point in the gospel, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life. So, understand this. Jesus walks to Jerusalem, not just risking, but knowing when he reaches Jerusalem, he will suffer the greatest suffering anyone has suffered. My favorite scene in all the Narnia movies, you know I love Narnia, but my very favorite scene is the scene in which Aslan is solemnly, but willingly, walking up the hill to the stone table. And he does it knowing that when he arrives there, he will be killed. That's courage. That's courage. You see, Jesus didn't just risk his reputation and his safety and his life. He willingly gave them. True courage, according to Jesus, is not just choosing not to protect something important, it's being willing to give that important thing up for the sake of something else more important. Now, the question this leaves us with is this. What areas of our life are we being a coward in right now? What areas of our life are we protecting good things, but I'm not willing to let them go, even though there is something more important at stake? Friends, we ought to be courageous, don't we? This is how you do it. Figure out what it is you are being a coward in, what it is you are refusing to let go of, in spite of something more important being at stake. I'm going to give us some examples while we're looking at these examples. Have a think about it today. I want to be courageous as of today. I'm going to make a change today to be courageous as opposed to cowardly. Here's example number one, talking to people about Jesus. Do we courageously bring up Jesus in conversation? Or are we afraid? Afraid they may stop liking us. afraid we might get a reputation as a God botherer. Now notice what we're doing. We're protecting our reputation at the expense of our neighbour's eternity. That's cowardice, isn't it? It's cowardice. Now, how do we combat that? If we want to be courageous, we need to look at what Jesus did. We need to give up our reputation. That's what he did. We need to say, as of today, I'm going to make a change today. I am no longer going to protect my reputation because the eternity of my neighbor is way more important. I mean, the fact is we already have all the acceptance we need from the King, don't we? So let's be courageous and give up our reputation as of today. Second example, generosity. Are we courageous in our giving? Or are we afraid? Afraid we won't have enough to spoil ourselves. Or won't have enough if a rainy day comes. Now notice what we're doing. We're protecting our financial security at the expense of others who actually don't have the essentials in life. That's cowardice. To be courageous with our money, we need to do what Jesus did. Jesus gave up the riches of heaven so that we could be spiritually rich. And we need to say, as of today, I'm making the decision now. I am no longer going to protect my financial security because giving to church and charity is of more importance. The fact is, we have all the security we need from knowing that we are more valuable to God than the birds of the air and the lilies of the field. So let's be courageous and give up our financial security today. Third and last example, leadership. Bible passage asks, who's stepping up to lead? The real question is on the men, even though the women are the courageous heroes of this story. The question is, which men are not stepping up to lead in their families? Which men are saying, let's pray as a couple. Let's read the Bible as a family. Let's go to church every week without fail. Who of our men are doing that? Or are we afraid to lead? We're afraid we'll lose our comfort through the stress of leadership. We're afraid we'll lose our acceptance because we might make the wrong decision or an unpopular decision. We're afraid we'll lose our power because Christian leadership we know is service, putting the needs of others first. Now notice what we've done. We've put our comfort and our acceptance and our power ahead of the well-being of those who have been placed in our charge to look after. And that is cowardice. If we want to be courageous, what do? We need to do what Jesus did. What did it cost Jesus to be king? It cost him everything. We need to say, whatever is holding me back from leading, whether it be comfort or approval or power, I'm going to give that thing up today. Now, the fact is, Jesus gives us all the comfort, acceptance, and power we'll ever need. So let's be courageous, men. And let's start being the decision maker today who puts the needs of others ahead of our own. Friends, will you make the decision today to be courageous? Or will you continue down the path of cowardice? If you want to choose the path of courage, then what are you willing to give up today? We're going to have a question time, but I'm going to give us 2 minutes now to reflect the quietness of our hearts. What is it that you need to give up, to let go of, to stop protecting, in order to start being courageous rather than a coward? 2 minutes, then we'll come back for questions. Right. I'll change gears and I'll take a couple of questions about this topic or this chapter. Ian? Good question. Does this model of male leadership equate to the workplace? Some would say that. So some would say in the workplace, women should not pursue roles of management. I don't think the Bible takes us that far. So I think in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, it sets up a model of male headship in the family. And as we see, the people of God who become a family, it's a type of family, the people of God are given the role, the men in the people of God are given the role of headship there as well. So the people of God today is the church. And I would say that the church pushes for male headship as the rule. Judges chapter 4 does give us an exception to that rule, doesn't it? So there are exceptions, but it's tricky sorting those exceptions out. But I don't think I would take it as far to say that the workplace does the same thing. So answer your question, no. Buddha. So Pete is saying that you can go too far and end up pushing people away from Jesus. And that's not our goal. So some people might be there at that point. My general experience has been, though, that we're at the other end of the scale. We're at the cowardly end of the scale. We are not ready to put our reputation on the line like Jesus did and talk to people about Christianity. If you get to that point, we'll pull you back, yeah. I don't think we're there yet. Jason. So outreach ministry. Okay. So Jason's question is, if the model is of male headship or leadership in the church, what about specific ministries? So he's given the example, the outreach ministry. Should the outreach ministry team be headed up by a man or a woman? Is that? Yeah. Okay. Look, I think it depends on the ministry. So for women's ministry, let's get the women leading the women's ministry. Men would just stuff it up, I think. For the men's ministry, the other way around. We should get a man leading the men's ministry. I think in general it's best to have male headship over mixed kind of ministries. But in terms of, it also depends on whether it's a word-based ministry or something else. Okay, so the authority that 1 Timothy 2 speaks about, I think, is basically the spiritual authority over the church. So it's linked in with teaching. There's an authority and a teaching aspect to it in 1 Timothy 2, if you want to look it up. In terms of, it might be cleaning. It might be, it might just be organizing the Bible study groups. I don't have like I'm not precious about having a man in that role, but in terms of teaching roles, so Bible study leaders, I would want a man to be leading a men's group or a man to be leading a mixed group. I'm happy, and the Bible tells us to have women leading women's groups. So I wouldn't be super precious about it depending on what the ministry is. It's hard to explain. But if it's a word-based ministry, I would be, I think the Bible calls us to have male leadership in those areas over mixed congregations. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's one or two topics you've brought up there, Barbara, but if I can bring it back to the topic today, so everyone agrees that it's horrible what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. Barbara has talked about, you know, should we, like, she talked about feminism, and I think feminism is a good thing because men have been oppressing women forever, since Genesis 3. I mean, that's one of the curses of Genesis 3. Sadly, it's going to continue until Jesus arrives because it's a curse that men will lord it over women. That's, you know, part of our sinful fallen nature, sadly. But I think it's a good thing that we're fighting against that. Jesus did. All right? Jesus treated women with utmost respect. Okay? He was countercultural with how he treated women. And I think we today as Christians should be countercultural in treating women with complete respect and love and humility and gentleness and kindness, okay? And I think, you know, the reason we needed feminism is because men have blown it. The problem, though, happens when feminism goes a step too far, and that's what I was talking about before. Equality is one thing, sameness is another. And I don't think men and women are the same. We've got, you know, guys can't have babies, okay? There's a difference. And I think because of that, God has told us in the Bible that he's created us different ways and we're good at different things. And so he's given us roles. So it's a tough topic. I mean, okay, like that's what I said at the beginning. Against better judgment, I'm doing a question time here. And I thank you that you've been so gentle with me because it's a hard topic. I find it hard getting up the front and talking about this. But I like that what you've said, Barbara, is that we need to be always fighting for better treatment of women. It's just that what we've got to work with is what God gives us. And what God gives us is not in the head of a state. I mean, we've had a female prime minister. Okay, there's nothing in the Bible against that. But the Bible says that in the church, he's left the role of leadership to men. And if you want to argue about that, you're not arguing against Brendan. You're arguing against the word of the Lord. Yes, Kula. Uh-oh. That was a really... You almost jumped out of your seat to get your head up there. It does. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good question. Coolest question is, what about in missionary situations? I would even add country Australia. Okay? Country Australia is really struggling to find ministers and men to lead and preach in the churches. What do we do? Deborah is a wonderful example of, like I said, the exception to the rule. And the exception was, where were the men? There was no men stepping up to lead. The one they could find, Barak, as Kula said, still decided not to lead by himself. He wanted to stand beside the woman. What should we do? I think that if there are no men, and it's a choice of no gospel or no sermon, or a gospel and sermon from a woman, you take the gospel and sermon from a capable woman. So I'm very happy to be sending out single female missionaries overseas, because they're going to places where there are no Christian men stepping up. And so I think the case in Deborah is a perfect example of the exception, where if there's no men to lead, and that's what I said before, if men aren't stepping up to lead, girls, let's get in there. Do what Deborah did. Show courage. Please, become missionaries. Go overseas and preach the gospel. So I thoroughly agree. Yeah. Yes, Dave. Okay. Dave's asked about women in the New Testament that have roles of leadership in the church. There are two that I think are thrown around. One is Phoebe, who's mentioned in Romans, and she's described as being outstanding among the apostles. I think that's an obscure text. I don't think it means that she was a leader or an apostle. She was just one of the great ones that the apostles, you know, were working alongside. The other is Priscilla, who with her husband was preaching the gospel to people like Apollos. So apart from that, I can't think of any who are actually leaders in the New Testament. You'd have to come back to me, sorry. I can't think of any that I know of that actually stepped up to lead other than those two. And I don't think they're actually taking on the role of the leader in the church. Priscilla was preaching the gospel, which is a good thing, with her husband. And Phoebe was, in ministry. I don't know if that necessarily means she was leading the church. So unless you can hit me with the example, sorry, I can't help you. But thank you, Dave. Yes, Denise. We're going to have to, this will be the last one, because we've still got communion, sorry. Yes. We haven't talked about that, no. I think we've had women bishops in Australia for a couple of years now. I think it was in, can someone correct me, was it in England? Was it the Church of England that did it just 2 weeks ago? Yeah, it was the Church of England. Yeah, so the Church of England in England have allowed females to be bishops. In Australia, we've been doing it for a while, not in Sydney. And the reason we don't do it in Sydney is because it's a leadership role in the church. And we follow what the Bible tells us, and the Bible says men should be bishops and senior ministers in churches. Yeah. All right, we've still got communion and prayers, and they are important things to do. So please come and see me afterwards. I'll make myself available to anyone who wants to talk about this topic. And let's keep praying, and let's be courageous.